Welcome to part two of the circulation and respiration module. I'm Dr. Rita Marie-Loscalzo, and in this part, we're going to talk about what can go wrong with the circulation and respiratory system. So cardiovascular is the circulation and respiration is the respiratory system. So we're going to talk about all the different things that you might see as clients present. Before we begin, let me just make sure that you know that the information in this presentation is not intended to replace a one-on-one relationship with a qualified healthcare professional. It's not medical advice. So if you're going through this for your own health, just make sure that if you have anything serious going on or you're on any medications, that you check in with your primary care doc before you do any of the things we talk about. And also when you're talking to your clients, is make sure that they're aware that you're not replacing medical care, but you are augmenting medical care. Before we jump right in, let's just look at our module in a glance. We already covered how the systems, the respiratory and the cardiovascular system, work. Now we're going to talk about what can go wrong. Once we've established what can go wrong, we're going to look at how do we assess, and then we're going to look at how do we balance, which I know is the fun part, but I really believe that you've got to have a good handle on how things work before you just start applying various therapeutics. So let's just take a look now at what can go wrong. There's actually a lot of stuff that can go wrong with both the respiratory system and the cardiovascular system. So let's jump right in.
You can have anatomic variances. You can have people who have chamber problems. You can have people who have holes between. I had a niece who was born as a baby, and she had the septal defect that had to be surgically repaired. And the issue was that she was tiny, and they didn't want to do it when she was too tiny, but they also didn't want her to get, you know, kids that are falling and they're running around and they're really active. And so I can't remember how old she was, but she was pretty young. It might have been before she was starting to walk, and it was pretty scary, you know, to have a little baby going in to have this septal defect. And then they had to keep her from being real active afterwards. But she's fine now. She's living a happy life, but she was born with an anatomical defect in the heart, and there are a number of those. And things like that, they find them out pretty quickly, and they can repair them. And infectious diseases, well, there's myocarditis, there's rheumatic fever that can affect the heart. There's all sorts of infectious diseases. You're not going to see a lot of infectious diseases in their ripe acute state when people come in, but they may have a history of infectious diseases. And then the blockages, we know about that. We know the blockages happen when the coronary artery gets blocked, and that's the artery that's actually bringing the heart muscle itself. And there's various branches there, and you've heard of people having a single, double, or triple, or quadruple bypass, right? And that means that multiple of those vessels that are coming and supplying the heart get blocked. And you've heard of angioplasty. So the ways that those blockages are resolved, there's three ways. If somebody has a blockage, it's either relieved surgically, it's relieved via an angioplasty where they put a balloon into the artery and then blow it up with the idea that they're going to break up that clot. The problem with that is they can shoot off pieces of the clot and they can get lodged somewhere else in a smaller vessel. So it's not the best. And then the third is diet and lifestyle. And we have study after study after study, and we have a lot of really famous cardiologists and MDs that are working with people with the blockages. You've got Caldwell Esselstein, great stuff that he's doing with people with it. We've got Dean Ornish, John McDougall. There's a number of big name people who are actually working with these people with their blockages. Well, what are they doing? Well, they're doing what you can do. They're teaching them how to eat. They're completely overhauling their diets. They're helping them with particular nutrients or supplements or herbs that they might need to get those blockages broken up. So it's really, there's dramatic shifts in the way that people are looking at this, and a lot more and more people are looking for alternative ways. When you start to talk to people about changing their diet, they go, oh, I don't know if I can do that. I don't know if I could give that up. One of the comments I make to them, they say, that's hard. I say, yeah. So which is harder in your opinion? Giving up this particular food, or having your chest cut open, your ribs cage broken, your heart surgically operated on in a multi-hour procedure, and then having it sewn back up and being kind of uncomfortable for quite a while. Which is harder? Giving up your Twinkies and this other stuff, or having that process? Now, when they look at it that way, most people don't think of it that way. They think of it as, well, this is the way it is. You know, I have this big blockage. My arteries are 95% blocked or 67% blocked or whatever. I just have to go have the surgery. And when you explain to them the track record, and I would highly recommend that you have on your shelves those books by those people that have written them, the Ornish and the Esselstein and McDougall and some of those people, and you may not agree with their dietary approach, but the point is you will have that and say, look, there's all these books out there, all these doctors that are doing this. There's a lot of MDs and cardiologists that are abandoning their knives to help people with blockages in the ways that you guys have. People don't have to be going to a cardiologist to learn how to eat right, to learn how to eat for good cardiovascular health. Not saying that you should tell people not to see their cardiologists. You want them to be checked and to make sure that things are, they're not going in danger. But the point is too, these blockages, our jobs, our roles is to catch people before they get there, to prevent them, because prevention is so much better. And it's been shown time and time again, study after study, how the proper diet and lifestyle, the ones that we know how to teach people how to follow, will support people in value. And they won't have to go in and get that dreadful diagnosis. Your coronary artery is 95% blocked. Ah! Then they're feeling really desperate. But if you get them before that, when they have maybe some other little things that they're coming in for, fatigue, shortness of breath, things like that, that you can then look at them and say, we can help you before it gets there. I see that your mother and father and, you know, three sisters all had heart attacks when they were in their 50s. There's some genetic thing there, plus there's the kind of diet that you grew up on. Let's work on that so you don't follow that same thing. That's what happened to me when I was in my 20s, and I watched, you know, my mother died when I was in my 30s, and my father 2 years later, and they died of heart attacks. But before that, my grandmother and grandfather had both, two grandfathers and one grandmother, had died of heart attacks. And I watched that happen, and it's like, wait a minute. You mean that what we eat and our stress levels and all this other stuff has a role in that? I said, heck, I'm going to just assume my arteries are 90% blocked and I'm going to the extreme and taking care of it. And part of your job as a health coach and as a nutritionist, however you practice, is going to be not just the knowing the science and being able to prescribe good protocols for them, but it's being able to connect with them in such a way that you inspire and motivate them into action. And you educate them. So the more you understand about how these systems work, you can explain it to people in a more layperson style that they'll connect with. Connect it to their personal life and their kids. Like, for example, I just was kind of mean after my mother and father both died. And I had two siblings that were still smoking cigarettes. There's nine of us in my family. And two of them were still smoking cigarettes. And I just shook my brother by the shoulders. I said, quit now or I'm going to kill you, because I just can't stand going through this again, right? You're killing yourself with these things. You have the family genetics to have these things happen. Look at all the people we've lost. Do you want your children to go through the pain we're going through right now? Do you want to put your children through that? And my sister had never thought about that. And it was, I didn't do it in as loving a way as I could have, and I would have if they had been my clients. But if they were my clients, I could have brought that same thing to their attention. Look, you've got these habits. These habits are creating this in your body. And based on, you know, family history, etc., if you let these things brew, your kids may have to go through losing you prematurely. How did you feel when you lost your mom? Not good. So if there's ways that you can do this in a very loving and gentle, kind way that inspires them to act, because they're acting for their children, and that's where people really get it, or for someone else that they love. So long story, long kind of rerouting from blockages, but blockages, that's our major cause of death in this country, is still heart disease. And most of it's preventable. And you have the tools to prevent it. and most of it, it's from blockages, right? Valve problems are usually, they're usually things that people are born with, and most of them are innocuous. There may be some that are problematic, like a mitral valve prolapse is generally not problematic. People find it out on a, you know, an echogram or something way late in life for other reasons, or they're going in for a routine cardiac screening because they hit 55 and they go, oh, you have mitral valve prolapse. Or they're getting examined and the doctor hears a little bit of the regurgitation at the valve, and it just doesn't really, for most people, cause problems. Okay, there are some that would. These are not the people you're going to be seeing in practice. When people have valve problems that are serious, that's not something that's going to be fixed by them eating a better diet and meditating, okay, because there's structural issues there. Then we have electrical issues. So the heart, we didn't even go into the whole electrical component of the heart. And the heart is the beating is controlled by electrical impulses. And oftentimes that goes off and people have heart, very erratic heartbeats, or they have palpitations or atrial fibrillation. It's all going out of whack. Those, again, are not issues that you're necessarily going to see a lot of. And there's a lot that you can do to support that person in good, healthy diet, nutrition that supports nerve conduction. So while I'm not going to say that you're going to cure people that have electrical cardiac problems, that it all goes into overall your job with somebody who presents that way and is under the care of a doctor for that, is to restore balance to their entire system. Heart muscle weakness, where the contraction is not so strong, right? It's just poorly, and people would manifest that by feeling weakness in their extremities and shortness of breath after very little exertion. And then lipid abnormalities, which is what you're going to see most, because you're going to be doing blood work on people, and you may be picking up lipid abnormalities even if they don't come in and say, hey, I have a heart problem, but you're seeing some lipid abnormalities that could create a problem, and you're going to be working with them on that. And finally, inflammation. And we're finding now that inflammation is actually the main cause of those plaques, the blockages that happen in the blood vessels. It's not just that somebody has high cholesterol. Somebody could have a cholesterol of 400, and maybe it's just a genetic thing that they have this hyperlipidemia, but they have pristine, crystal clear vessels. That cholesterol is not going to deposit on those vessels. It's when those vessels get inflamed, and they get inflamed by lots of things in people's diet and lifestyle. Hydrogenated fats, right? Hydrogenated fats are a huge issue when it comes to damaging the blood vessel walls. Oxidized fats, doesn't have to be the ones that are hydrogenated in the lab, but you take somebody who takes like canola oil or sunflower oil or peanut oil, and they throw it in a pan and they heat it up, and they heat it up and then they fry their food in it. Those oils, once they hit a certain temperature, they become oxidized. And it's somewhere around the 120 for most of the oils. Olive oil and coconut oil have a higher heat temperature before they become oxidized. For olive oil, it's somewhere in the 200s, and for coconut oil, it's somewhere in the 300s. So when you have people who are heating fats, they can get into trouble with oxidized fats in the bloodstream, the free radical formation, then causing damage to the lining, the delicate lining called the endothelium of the blood vessel. So what can go wrong in the respiratory system? Now, the respiratory system, there's a lot of things that can go wrong. Asthma is generally caused by some sort of blockage in the bronchioles. The bronchioles can be blocked from inflammation. The inflammation can be caused by some kind of damage in there. Most often it's caused by allergies. Asthma can also be a constriction of those bronchioles, like people who are real sensitive to cold. When cold air gets in, it constricts it down. So for some people, they have asthma like it's all the time. They just have problems breathing all the time unless they use their little inhalers. For some people, they have asthma when they get around cats. My husband's like that, very allergic to cats. When he's around a cat for very long, he gets asthmatic and he wheezes. There's a wheezing. You can actually hear the wheezing as the air is flowing over the inflammation, the blockages. What the general treatment of asthma is an inhaler. People take this inhaler, which has epinephrine in it, which is a catecholamine that will dilate the vessels, open up the vessels. Another way that people can get relief, and that's what my husband will generally do when he has it, he doesn't have an inhaler anymore. What he'll do is he'll have a cup of coffee, and the caffeine will dilate the vessels and allow him to breathe again. Another option is some of the herbs, like ephedra. Ephedra got a bad rap because people were using it as a weight loss herb because it sped up the metabolism. But it actually can be used to open up the bronchioles and allow somebody to breathe in the case of an asthmatic. So that's asthma. Infectious disease is when you have anything from a viral infection to a bacteria to a fungal infection. A lot of things can affect the lungs. Most common is when somebody has a cold that then drops down into their lungs, and it's usually viral. It could be a viral pneumonia. It can be viral bronchitis, and bronchitis would be more of the inflammation or infection that would be in the bronchioles. It hasn't made it into the lungs. The difference between pneumonia and bronchitis would be that the pneumonia is actually a focus of infection in the lungs themselves, in the bronchioles. Now, with an infectious bronchitis, there's not really a lot of medical treatment. They just say wait for it to go away or use a nebulizer. And they'll usually put some steroids or something in the nebulizer to help to open up the bronchioles, and they'll put antibiotics that way. Well, you don't put antibiotics, sorry. That's for pneumonia that's bacterial. But the problem is a lot of times when someone picks up and goes to the doctor to be evaluated for an infection, for coughing, for wheezing, for those sorts of things, the docs will immediately put them on an antibiotic. And in fact, the antibiotics can be contraindicated at that point, because an antibiotic is really good if there's an infection. And if somebody has a really, especially debilitated person, has a bacterial pneumonia, it's oftentimes warranted to give them an antibiotic because you need to give them something that's going to cause them to get immediate relief. Whereas you can do it naturally and herbally, but if it's in a frail individual and they have a really virulent bacteria, you may not have the time. You have to get stuff in there pretty quickly. I've seen lots of people curing pneumonia without it. I've seen people do it with herbs. However, you just have to really help people, especially those people that come in and say, I want to do everything natural, is to help them, to guide them to see a doctor if you're feeling like they are frail and they may not be able to handle it. Okay, and it's definitely something you don't want to get into a situation where you're over your head, and make sure that if you're working with somebody with pneumonia, that they're also working with a doctor as well. Because, you know, as much as we can say we can help a lot of people with a lot of things, oftentimes it's not 100%, and you don't want to be the one that gets blamed for this person not going on antibiotics. So it's really important to be careful there. So infectious diseases can affect the bronchi, it can affect the lungs themselves. It can be in the throat, in the larynx. People call it laryngitis. The larynx is the voice box in the throat, in the airway. So that can be problematic. And then you have strep throat. They have an infection in their throat, and that can affect their ability to breathe. It can be in their sinuses. It's sinusitis, an infection in the sinuses. When we look at ways to work with people, we'll learn about various ways that we can help people when they have sinus problems, and some of the things that we can help people to do to prevent it if they are subject to chronic sinusitis. Part of the immune system, we covered it a little bit there, but we'll go into it a little bit more as part of the respiratory system. Okay. Now, nebulizers can be awesome, and there's a number of naturopaths and herbalists that use nebulizers to actually deliver herbs deep inside the lungs. A nebulizer is a gadget that will push down air containing like droplets. It takes the liquids and it converts them into droplets that can go into the lungs, so it can go deep into the lungs. There's an ND, he's in Arizona, and I think he teaches at the naturopathic college out there. And I've listened to a number of his lectures on cases where he had people with lung cancer and pneumonia and various things, and they weren't getting better. And he wanted to see what he could do, and he was thinking about the different herbs that were in his arsenal and how they could affect the lungs and how they can help bronchi and how they can help with infections. And he thought, well, how do you deliver it? Because it's in the lungs. It's sometimes hard to deliver medications there. So he thought, wow, a nebulizer. So he started this regime where he used NAC and licorice and to open up the airways and to get into the lungs. And he had phenomenal results over and over again. And so he just started to use that as a more routine practice. And then using other kinds of herbs. And I don't remember all of the ones he's used, but really interesting stuff. And then I know someone who's in the ERC program has been having this cough that just wouldn't go away after she had pneumonia years ago and has gone through pretty much, I mean, so many things between Hippocrates and doing fasting and she's just still having this cough that won't go away. And finally got her Kaiser or whatever her plan was to do some more deep testing. I'd said, you know, doing some kind of cultures, figuring out what's in there, and turned out that she had a fungal infection. And they wanted to put her on some really strong steroids and antibiotics, and she doesn't want to do it. So she started looking around, and I mentioned to her about the nebulizer and that she should contact this doctor out there, and she wasn't able to get through, but she contacted Hippocrates, and Hippocrates told her about using the nebulizer with a particular kind of a silver, colloidal silver type thing to get down in there. So it could be really creative. Now, getting a nebulizer is usually a prescription thing. However, given the age of internet, everything that used to be only available to practitioners is now a lot of it is available to the general public. So people can order their own nebulizers. I did a search when she was looking, and there are a number of places that sell nebulizers. So it's kind of a gray area. You don't want to be prescribing things for people to put in nebulizers, but I want you to know that you may want to be opening their minds to these things and giving them resources of folks. You probably can get, if you're really interested in pursuing this aspect, this respiratory aspect further, it was either from a Gaia seminar or the Herbs, Medicines from the Earth. These are two herbal seminar series they do them. I think they do them once or twice a year. And you can generally go back and order. I've never been to them, but I've ordered the audios, the little cassettes. It used to be, when I did it, it was cassettes. And then they got it where that they would give you just all the MP3s, and it got to be much less expensive. Instead of being $300 for a set of cassette tapes, it was like $100 for a set of MP3 downloads that you can listen to. Asthma, infectious disease, pneumonia, allergies. We've gone through allergies in detail in the immune system. Inflammation, whether it be from infectious disease or it could be from trauma, there's a number of things that can cause inflammation. People who have chronic sinusitis and chronic allergies and chronic infectious disease in their sinuses, they end up getting inflammation. And they may be having this chronic congestion or chronic feeling like they can't breathe. And a lot of it can be because there's some scar tissue that's formed from all the infections that they've had. So I like to use neti pots for people who have the issues in the sinuses. And you can deliver herbs as medicines in their neti pot. Emphysema is where they cannot get the air out of their lungs. There's an inflation, there's an inflammation in there. And it's really challenging. These people can barely like pick up a fork and eat. I remember watching my aunt, and she died of emphysema. She was an avid smoker her entire life, and she got emphysema, and she continued to smoke in spite of the fact that they told her she should stop. And I watched her get progressively worse. She was an active woman. She loved to swim, and she loved to go fishing, and she just was very active. And it was really sad to see her slow down to the point where she could barely walk from one room to the next, and then she had to get on oxygen. And when they told her she had to get on oxygen, she was still smoking. And she didn't stop smoking until she was on oxygen. And of course, you can't smoke when you're on oxygen. And then she wheeled it around with her, and then she just got progressively worse and worse, and then she was confined to bed. And it was a long and slow death, and she was very young. She was maybe 64 or 5. She was in her early 60s when she died, but she just seemed like such an old woman because of what she'd been through. We take for granted. We just breathe. We're talking and we're breathing at the same time. But when you're struggling for every breath and you can't get it out and you can't get it in and you can't get it out, the circulation, the oxygenation doesn't happen to the tissues, and so they can't function. Everything starts to just slow down and deteriorate. So it's really a challenge. And then cancer, of course, many of you, I can tell stories about family members for just about every one of these conditions. I have an aunt who died of lung cancer. And again, she was a smoker up until she got diagnosed with lung cancer. And even then, it took her a while to get off of it. And it was just really sad to see. I had a brother-in-law who died of lung cancer, he's 50. And it was really sad. And he was one that I gave that kind of, hey, look, I know it's hard. I wanted to send him to Dr. Lodi. He was living very close by in Arizona. And I basically said, go to their website, take a look. I told my sister, and they looked. And my sister goes, let's go. And he's like, oh, but he's going to make me change my diet. I don't want to do that. And so he went the medical route. He was willing to take some juices, and he was willing to take some herbs that his brother, who's an acupuncturist, would give him. But he wasn't willing to change the habits. He wasn't willing to stop. He had stopped smoking years ago, which was good, but he had smoked for quite a number of years. He smoked because he got a bleeding ulcer, and the doctors told him if he didn't stop smoking, his ulcer was going to keep going and he was going to die. So he stopped smoking, but he wasn't willing to give up the food. He wasn't willing to make the changes, and it was not enough, and he had surgery, and then got pneumonia, and then got all kinds of stuff, and then died at the age of 50. And so it's a devastating disease, and it can come on people at any age. I became friends with a woman who lived next door to us. She was the nanny of the people next door, and she was very into spiritual practices and nutrition to an extent, and she had gotten a cough, and it was everybody else in the family had gotten a cough, and she just figured she had the cough, she had the cold, the flu, whatever, and then it wasn't going away. And she went and got a chest x-ray, and she came in to show me before she'd gotten to talk to the doctor about what it was. She just got the x-ray somehow, they gave it to her, I guess, and she came over and showed me the x-ray, and I took one look at her x-ray, and you know, sometimes you get an intuitive hit about things. And I got this, I just looked at her x-ray, and I'm like, oh my God, she's going to die. And I don't know where that came from, and I'm looking at it going, well, what could this be? It looks like a freaking big, huge tumor. But, well, maybe it's, you know, maybe it's pneumonia, and it's consolidated, and maybe it's scar tissue, and maybe it's this, and, you know, I'm trying to support her, and it was very, very long, it was lung cancer, and she died a couple of months later. So it can happen, you know, and so when you're working with people, if they do have this cough that won't go away, don't just keep trying, like, what's another good cough herb, and, you know, maybe they're eating something else they're allergic to, and really have them checked out. And I will say that after that, it was about a year after that, I had this cough that I got bronchitis, and I don't ever get sick, but it was a long, long sequence of stressful events in my life. And I got this cough, and it wouldn't go away, and I was freaked out, and I actually went into a doctor who was more alternative, an MD, and I said, I want a sputum culture, and I want a chest x-ray. And she looked at me, she goes, you have viral bronchitis. I said, I don't know if I have viral bronchitis, and I told her about, you know, how this person, she just died, and she had a lung tumor. I want to know what I have before it's something, before it becomes really bad. And she was like, okay, I'll humor you, I'll do it, but you have viral bronchitis. And sure enough, I had viral bronchitis, nothing showed up. I had perfectly clear lungs, I had perfectly clear sputum culture. But it freaked me out. It was scary enough to see someone that young, that quickly die. Apparently she had had it, and, you know, she probably was coughing for a while and all that. But, you know, the other thing she was working on a lot was grief, which is from Chinese medicine perspective. You know, we're talking right now the Western medicine approach and weaving in our nutrients and herbs, but there is a whole sequence, there's a whole body of information related to the acupuncture meridians and the emotions that are going to predispose somebody to get illnesses in those areas. So yes, we need to remove the allergens, and yes, we need to remove the hydrogenated fats and the things that are going to cause them problems, and yes, we can supply them with herbs. But if this, she was a person that was in a perpetual state of grief from the time she was very young, and I started talking to her about that, and it just was caught too late. It's caught too late to really do anything about. So there's a lot of things that go in, and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, somebody with a history of chronic bronchitis that just gets the bronchitis all the time, you get scar tissue, and the airways get scarred, and they get inflamed, and you get this chronic obstruction, and it's very challenging for people when they have that. So there's a lot that you can do with people before the what goes wrong becomes really serious. And that's what we're here for, is to help people to really get into balance and to look at all the places and all the clues that they might be out of balance. So let's look at a few diseases of the cardiovascular system. an aortic aneurysm. You can see that in the belly there, right over the belly button. There's this big red balloon. That's basically what happens, is the walls of the vessels get weak and they don't hold the blood in and they start to balloon out. What happens with an aortic aneurysm is that they balloon out enough, if there's enough pressure, and there's a big vessel, there's a lot of blood going through that. As those walls get weaker and weaker, you run the risk of a burst aneurysm. We had a friend who had her husband died suddenly. You know, guy in 40-something, and he had no idea that he had an aneurysm, and it was a brain aneurysm. And he just died, because there were no clues before that. I think he had some headaches and stuff. And it just burst, and he died. But the aortic aneurysms often don't present as cardiovascular-type symptoms. They present, generally speaking, as somebody will come in with unrelenting back pain. And if you're a body worker and you do body work on them and you do adjustments on them and you do all this stuff, you need to be able to know and differentiate. And that was a big part of my training, was differentiating between organic disease and musculoskeletal disease. So you knew whether, oh, well, we're going to adjust this person or do some physical therapy on this person versus they need to have an x-ray. So, you know, if somebody does have chronic unrelenting back pain that's going on, and there's often a throbbing associated with it, and if you were to listen over their belly, you might hear or feel that pulsating, a really strong pulsating in an aneurysm. But it's a serious issue, and that's something that, you know, I was taught during my training in x-rays, is when you do an x-ray, how to look for it, how to see if there's an aneurysm or potential of an aneurysm, and refer them out to be evaluated. There's, you know, not a lot that's done. They put stents in sometimes. Not exactly sure the exact ways that aortic aneurysms. I know for aneurysms in the brain, a friend of ours, her young son, had an aneurysm, and it manifested with, you know, some drooping of the eye and some headaches and some other symptoms related to his head, and they did an MRI and he had an aneurysm. And he's fine now, but it was, you know, 6 or 8 months of hell with them. They were trying to do it with a stent, and they didn't want to do a bypass, and eventually they ended up having to do a bypass. And that would be, you know, a big aortic aneurysm might need to have some sort of bypass done. And that's a pretty serious surgery. Angina, some people say angina, some people say angina. I kind of cross between them, depending on who I'm talking to. It's when there's a temporary decrease in the blood supply to the heart muscle, and there's a short-lived heart pain. Heart pain is usually easy to differentiate between heart pain and, say, musculoskeletal pain, and it's usually something that feels like pressure, like a pushing or a pressure in the chest. And with angina, they will get these short bursts of it, and then it goes away. It doesn't last very long. You may get the pain down the arm, which is one of the ways that you diagnose or not diagnose, but assess or evaluate if somebody's saying they have chest pain versus arm pain. I'll tell you, you know, a quick story about that. My son called me up one day. I was in California. He was on his way to take a test to be certified. He was a certified lifeguard, but had to take an open water test to be certified for this particular body of water he was going to go to. He was driving down there after this test that he had just taken. He's driving down to work, and he started getting this chest pain. And he called me up because, Mom, I'm driving to work and I have chest pain. I don't know what to do. What is this? What this could this be? So I started asking him some questions, you know, because there's questions you ask somebody to differentiate. Is it a heart attack? He was fearing he was having a heart attack at the ripe young age of 19. And he said to me, I asked the questions. I said, well, is it a specific spot? Can you touch it? If you touch it, is it sore? Is it radiating into your shoulder and your arm? Is it radiating up into your chin? And he basically said no to some of those things. I said, if you move your arm, does it hurt more or less? Is there a position of your arm that makes it better or worse? These are questions to ask, but we ask questions. That's the reason for asking all these questions about a chief complaint. And he basically said, yeah, when I move it this way or whatever. I said, have you been doing anything? Well, I didn't know he had just had that test that morning or what he had to do. I said, if you're holding your arms above your head, like were you painting something? He goes, well, during the test this morning, we had to tread water for 5 minutes while holding something. I don't remember what he had to hold. Something that weighed a lot above their arms. I'm like, honey, I think it's from that. He just like breathed a sigh of relief. He goes, yeah, that makes sense. It takes, because it's, you know. But that's the kind of thing you want to take people through, because a lot of people go to the emergency room when they have chest pain. I've had friends who've done that, and they, you know, end up spending $10,000 in tests at the emergency room and found out that they had strained a muscle, an intercostal muscle. So it's really, you know, up to you. If somebody, if one of your clients is saying, yeah, I had this pain, I keep getting this chest pain, to determine whether you need to send them out to get examined and to get checked, or whether it seems like it's a musculoskeletal, and then you would send them off to a physical therapist or a chiropractor or a massage therapist to get fixed. So I had a person who came to see me, and this was many, many years ago. It was within my first 3 years of practice, and she came in to see me with this chest pain that was outrageous. But she came to see me because she'd already been through, you know, tens of thousands of dollars of various kinds of tests and echocardiograms and CTs and PET scans and everything, and nobody could find anything wrong with her heart and or her lungs. Everything was perfect. But still she had this horrible chest pain. So I did an examination and found she had a couple of ribs out of alignment. And after three adjustments, her chest pain went completely away. So it's really important when we're working with people to differentiate the things that we can like step in with and might be a good candidate for nutrition and herbs from something that could be a serious pathological condition that's an emergency, or whether it is something with their heart. And if they're having angina, then working with them on all the things we talk about in the treatment section when we're working on improving their cardiac function and their blood vessel function, which would include the things like, you know, reducing inflammation and managing their fat intake and certain herbs and nutrients. Another thing that can go wrong is arrhythmia. An arrhythmia is the rhythm of the heartbeat. So the heartbeats should be pretty rhythmic. As we've talked about when we talk about stress and heart math, we don't have an exact number of seconds or milliseconds between heartbeats. So if you measure your pulse and it's 60, that doesn't mean that there's your heart is beating every second. What that means is that sometimes there's a second and a quarter, sometimes it's three quarters of a second. So when you map that out, that's called your heart rate variability, and it should be a nice smooth sine wave. It's not going to be flat, and in fact, a flat rhythm of every second that heart beats on is actually a not a good sign. It's a sign that somebody's really out of whack. So arrhythmias are when the heart beats irregularly. So instead of that general normal heart rate variability, they may have really rapid, and then it slows down, and then it's really, really rapid, and then it slows down. That's an arrhythmia that needs to be checked. It needs to be find out if it's a conduction defect of the heart. Atherosclerosis, we've been talking about that. That's the blockages. Stroke or heart attack. They're the same disease, guys. Now, one is in the head, and one is in the heart. Basically, a stroke is a heart attack of the head. There are a couple of different things. You can have what people will call a mini stroke, and a mini stroke is also called a transient ischemic attack. Transient ischemic attack. And that basically is a very short burst of lack of blood flow to the brain. And it deprives the brain of oxygen for a little bit of time. It could be, you know, a couple of seconds. It could be up to a minute or two. And the person will feel like really whacked out at that point. They may just lose their ability to focus, they may black out, they may just feel some weird like loss of sensation in a part of their body or an inability to speak because it's affected their face. So that's and it's short-lived and then it goes away. And there's no permanent damage visible on the outside. They seem to go back to normal. But that's a clear indication that their vascular system needs work. So if somebody tells you, I've had a few mini strokes or I've had a few transient ischemic attacks, that's when you want to work with them on helping to really support their cardiovascular function. Okay? So a stroke is basically a heart attack of the brain. A stroke itself is when there's a longer deprivation of oxygen. And if it's long enough, sometimes that part of the brain that it's got a deprivation to will actually die. Okay? Ischemia is the lack of blood supply to a particular area. So if you have ischemia in a foot, say in the diabetes, you might lose the sensation, you may lose the blood supply to that, you may lose the foot. In the heart, ischemia is where part of the heart muscle may be damaged from that. When my father died of a heart attack, we had them do an autopsy to see what it was, why he died. We assumed it was a heart attack, and it was a heart attack, but they said there was an indication based on little bits of scar on his heart that he'd had other mini heart attacks before, and he'd never really known. That can happen in the brain as well. So small pieces of the brain that you might lose function to, but you don't even realize it until it becomes bigger. With the heart, blockage of the main coronary artery is going to cause a massive heart attack, and the person could die, which is what happened to both of my parents. They just died suddenly of a massive heart attack. And then there could be the smaller heart attacks where the person would survive. If someone tells you that they have had a heart attack and they've survived, again, you want to really look carefully at their diet, at their lifestyle, at their stress, and work with them and counsel them about how they can prevent having another heart attack and how they can rebuild. High blood pressure, hypertension it's also called. There's several different types of high blood pressure. You have labile hypertension, where a person has periods of hypertension that come and go. Sometimes their blood pressure is high, sometimes it's normal, sometimes it's high, sometimes it's normal. Then you have more of an essential hypertension where it's high all the time. It's just high. And what is a high blood pressure? Well, generally it's considered 90 on the diastolic, which is the lower number, is considered to be the threshold. If they hit 90 or above, that's a time when they're considered pre-hypertensive. Now more and more, and I don't know if this is driven by true science or the pharmaceuticals, but they're looking at, oh, a person has hypertension if their blood pressure is above 80, and we should put them on blood pressure medication. Remember that happened when my sister was in the hospital dying of cancer, and she was on all kinds of medications, and they added a new medication. I said, what are you adding that medication? No, they did her blood pressure and said, oh, we're going to have some blood pressure medication. I said, what? I mean, she's already got a lot of medication on here. She's trying to recover. And they said, well, her blood pressure is, 120 over 88. I'm like, what do you want to put her on medication for? Oh, well, anything over 80, we should be medicating for. That's what the new guidelines are telling us. They're like, okay. I mean, I could see being cautious, but I would say anything over 80 maybe is a warning that you've got to be dealing with it. So high blood pressure, we've talked at length in our blood sugar class about how blood sugar imbalances can lead to high blood pressure. We talked about stress and cortisol raises the blood pressure. So constantly being in that alert state can raise the blood pressure. We know that when we take somebody through a series of heart math activities, we can lower their blood pressure dramatically by 20 or 30 points almost instantly by getting them out of the sympathetic nervous system state, which raises the blood pressure, into the parasympathetic nervous system state. So high blood pressure is something that I would say, you know, either have them, if you can take their blood pressure, or if you can't, then send them off as part of your new patient evaluation, new client evaluation for everybody. Send them off to the local drugstore and put the dollar in the machine and get their blood pressure taken. Okay? Blood pressure can also be low, which is hypotension. It's more rare. It's more common to have an orthostatic hypotension. Orthostatic hypotension is when the blood pressure is low and positionally related. So somebody's lying down, their blood pressure may be perfectly fine, and then when they stand up, their blood pressure goes low. It's like, oh, whenever I stand up, the room spins, I get dizzy. And as you most likely recall, the low blood pressure at that point of time is related to adrenals oftentimes, when they can't get the blood pressure up when they stand up. And then there's peripheral vascular disease. And peripheral vascular disease is a condition whereby there's a shortage of blood supply to the peripheral. So peripheral vascular disease can be as a result of diabetes. Diabetes makes damage to the peripheral vasculature. It could be related to smoking. There's a condition called Berger's disease that's related to smoking, and people have really poor circulation. You'll know that they have poor circulation by the cold extremities and lack of good healing in those areas. So that's peripheral vascular disease. So a lot of things that can contribute to imbalances in lipids, and it can be other parts of the body that are causing it. So thyroid in particular is really a big contributor to high cholesterol. If you have someone who has high cholesterol, in spite of them having a pretty decent diet, and you wouldn't expect them to have high cholesterol, could be either familial hypercholesterolemia, or it could be related to their thyroid. Hypothyroid is related to high cholesterol. Adrenal stress. Adrenal stress can elevate your lipids. It can elevate your blood pressure. It can elevate your lipids. It can also cause the increase in sugars in the blood, which then get converted to more triglycerides. And when you have insulin resistance, you're going to have higher triglycerides and you'll have lipid abnormalities. Of course, insulin resistance, we've talked about that ad infinitum. Diabetes, same. Fatty liver. Fatty liver can cause lipid abnormalities. Remember, the liver is where the cholesterol is made. When you have fatty liver, you don't actually do the process of controlling the management of cholesterol to and from. Biliary stasis, which is their bile. Your cholesterol is eliminated in your bile. So if somebody has biliary stasis, meaning that the bile ducts are not moving, they're not pumping, it could be biliary stasis from having no gallbladder. The bile isn't flowing as freely as it should and it's getting stuck, then you're not going to be eliminating those the LDLs and the cholesterol in the bile. Poor fat metabolism. Again, somebody doesn't handle fats well. We see low triglycerides when somebody isn't absorbing their fat real well. We can see very, very low cholesterol when somebody isn't actually absorbing their fats really well. Hypoglycemia, where the sugars in the blood go really super low, that can affect the fats. Nutrient deficiencies, and we'll talk more about that in our protocol section. There's a lot of nutrients that are important for lipids. And then multiple sclerosis. Multiple sclerosis can have an effect on lipids.
Let's end our presentation on what can go wrong with the kind of symptoms you may see. Somebody's not going to come in and say, I have COPD, I have an aneurysm, I have peripheral vascular disease. They may, because they may have been diagnosed before. But in general, they're going to come in with signs. And some of these can be a little vague. And if they haven't been to a practitioner who's careful and doing a differential diagnosis, which is what they call it in medicine, or they haven't been to a practitioner at all and they are coming up with these symptoms and explaining to you what's going on and what they want help for and what you want to ask if they are not real explicit. So these are some of the symptoms. Calf pain on exertion. That can be indicative of peripheral vascular disease. It can also be indicative of a blood clot. You want to be careful with that one. And there's a couple of tests that you can do. We'll look at when we go to assessment. It could be muscle cramps on exertion, right? That could be a hypoxia situation. Swelling of the extremities, edema in the ankles, especially if there's a bluishness to that. That can indicate that there's a problem with the heart. It can be chest pain, like that tightness in chest. So whenever you're asking about chest pain, you want to be really careful to ask the differential type questions. So anything that's related to the musculoskeletal system will have some element of change to it on various movements. So somebody can complain about chest pain. I know lots of people have that, and I told you a story about that, that it's really just musculoskeletal. It can be a subluxation of the ribs. It could be tension or tightness or soreness or a strain of the intercostal muscles. It can be so many things. You want to ask those questions. You know, does it hurt to raise your hands over your head? Does it hurt when you spread your arms out? Does it hurt to lift things? The pain associated with a heart attack or with angina is a tightness in the chest. And some people describe it as you feel like there's an elephant sitting on your chest. So the other thing is shortness of breath with moderate exertion, right? We expect people to get short of breath when they go out and, you know, run 5 miles. We don't expect them to be short of breath when they get up off the couch to go to the refrigerator to get another beer, right? That's shortness of breath. That's severe and problematic. And we see that a lot with emphysema. We see it certainly with chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. Air hunger, grasping for that air. I can't get enough, right? That's another sign. Heavy, irregular breathing. So ask them about this stuff. How is your breathing? Observe that if you're actually seeing them versus talking on the phone. But sometimes you can even detect these things when you're talking to them on the phone. Irregular heartbeat. right? They say, oh, my heart is, it just feels like it's irregular. Or if you actually have them in there, you have them take their pulse, or you're licensed to touch and you can actually listen. There's a lot of ways to figure that out. Actually, the HeartMath device, the M-Wave, will give them feedback about whether their heart rate is super irregular. Rapid breathing and confusion, right? And they're confused because why? They're not getting enough oxygen to their heads. You want to suspect cardiovascular or respiratory, a combination of situations there. Redness of the face, but for no apparent reason, right? They just have it. Now, of course, that could be a skin thing. That could be rosacea, but you want to be really searching for that sort of thing. Coughing at night, that's not associated with being ill, that they're just lying in bed and they start to cough. They're not coughing during the day. It's not an allergic reaction. You have to rule out allergy, right? You want to rule out, well, did you just get a new mattress cover? What kind of detergent are you using? That's the kind of thing you want to ask when somebody says, well, I cough, but it's only at night. But it could be a sign of respiratory or cardiovascular disease. Fatigue and sleepiness, loss of consciousness. That one's obvious, right? They're going to tell you about that, but maybe not. So make sure you ask that about. Now, fatigue obviously is a very vague symptom, but it's fatigue in conjunction with some of these other things. Cyanosis, which is a lack of circulation to the extremities. So their fingers turn blue, their nails turn blue, their lips can turn blue. And pallor too, lack of, again, oxygenation to the face. So these are all the kinds of things that you should be looking for when somebody comes in. So you can differentiate between fatigue that's related to thyroid dysfunction or fatigue that's related to a more serious issue with their heart or their lungs. And we'll end with something most of you probably know or at least are aware of, smoking. Like, you've got to get people to stop smoking. I rarely have a patient intake where I find out that they're smoking, but I do occasionally. And sometimes you're working with somebody for a while and they're very secretive about their smoking. They don't tell you because they're embarrassed. And this can thwart their progress dramatically. So the tar and all the other substances in the cigarette smoke destroy or paralyze the cilia. And they make it really hard for them to remove particulate matter. So they're going to be coughing. They're going to be gasping. And this may not be an early sign, but it's definitely a problem. And I attribute some of the problems I had in my 20s with my sinuses to having lived in a household for 22 years where my parents were smoking in the house. Now, I would leave as an older teenager because I just couldn't stand it. I hated it. But when I was a kid, I had no choice. Mom walking around with me in one arm and a cigarette in the other. So it damages the cilia, makes them more paralyzed. And people who are living in a household where other people smoke are going to have a lot of problems later in life. So ask those questions. Did your parents smoke while you were living in the house? Did other relatives? Plus the whole issue of third-hand smoke. So even if they don't smoke around you, you go back in, like I was leaving, but I go back in and it's the third hand smoke, which is all that smoke that gets into the carpets and the upholstery and all that. So really important to ask these questions about smoking. It causes the lungs to produce more mucus, and because the cilia are damaged, they can't get rid of it. And a persistent cough, which obviously we know. The lungs try to get rid of the particulate matter. And smokers are way more susceptible to all the other things, especially lung cancer. My aunt with the emphysema who just wouldn't give up the smoking. My other aunt with the lung cancer who wouldn't give up the smoking. So ask about their smoking history. They may not be smoking now, but ask if they lived in a household where people smoked, have a spouse that smokes, go to visit relatives who smoke, go to smoky bars. And also, did they have a history? Did they experiment and play around with smoking when they were a teenager? I never did, but my siblings did. I was the only one that did. Well, there were three of us, the dad of nine, that didn't smoke. And I just hated it. My parents would say, okay, here's some money, go to the store and get me some cigarettes. And it was like 2 blocks away to walk to the store back where I lived. I would refuse. Once I got to be of an age where I just said, this is, no, I'm not going to kill you. You want to smoke? Go get it yourself. So really be careful about asking these questions, right? Exposure to smoke, secondhand smoke, thirdhand smoke, or primary smoke. We're at the end of our what can go wrong part of the module. And the next part, part three, is on assessment. And some of these things I interwove. I told you about some of the assessment things, but we're going to pull it together in a nice little bow. We're going to talk about the history questions. We're going to talk about the lab testing that you can do to help assess people for cardiovascular and respiratory problems.